Well, good morning. I want to conclude the sermon that I started last time concerning that question, is Christ the true head of his church? Do we still believe it? And that question is something we need to always consider in our lives, no matter how long we've been in the church. A question that helps us focus on the vision. The church, he established and he stated, the gates of hell will never prevail. But sometimes we feel that way, though. I feel like everything's crumbling. It's because we put the wrong vision in place of that true vision. But we know and build, and we talked about Matthew 7, digging deep onto that foundation, building on that rock. Because Christ didn't say build on the rock so that you look pretty and everything would look great, and the church will always just stand on a hill, no damage, nothing. No, he says you build on that rock because the rains will come, the winds will blow, the floods will be there, but those who do this, they won't fall. They will survive. The church will survive. And we can't confuse the failures of the administrations of men with that church. Men make mistakes. We all make mistakes. But there has to be an expectation, a clear expectation for us who are called to build on this rock, a clear vision. And again, I mentioned this last time, not only stirs a desire, not only we don't want to just be here. It's great to be here. But there's got to be more than just a desire. God gave us this law. God gave us this way of life to help us remember and understand what he requires of those who have the honor to be here. We have to have a desire and be willing to do what is required. God doesn't want destructive symptoms to go unaddressed. Things can happen. And if we don't address them and we don't get back to that foundation, those bad symptoms will continue to develop. Symptoms that won't edify, but they would defile. They will defile us individually. We're going to see that today. Individually, but it eventually reaches out and it touches everyone. Everyone in that house. So much so that we attempt to destroy the house from the inside out. Remember that statement we started the first sermon on this was Proverbs 29:18. A very important aspect of what it means to be part of this way of life. Where there is no vision, the people perish. So if we take our vision off the head, our sights of what he says, what he desires, what he requires, we won't be on the way, the path that gives us truth, that brings life. God didn't bring us here to kill us. He brought us here for that we can live. That we can learn to what it means to have a home later. If a people do not have a strong connection with who they are, why they do what they do, an understanding of their purpose and who leads them, Satan will take advantage of the opportunity to insert strategically placed stumbling blocks so that we'll destroy ourselves. We talked about that, and we're going to go deeper into that. Why? Why God really tests our hearts, sometimes pretty intensively. Because he wants that purification. He wants us to really know where we are, digging past what we think we're standing to get to where we know we should be standing. And I was reading a ministerial journal back in 2002. And this, I just want to read a couple sentences from that that really struck me that I wanted to share as it really sets the stage of what we will finish covering and kind of encapsulate what we covered already. In this journal, this statement goes like this. Stress builds as one faces controversies, as one faces conflicts between brethren, conflicts between brethren in ministry, conflicts between the administration when there's disharmony. At times, we may feel that going to our brother, going to the minister, going to another member may result in our being impaled or stabbed in the back instead of a peaceful resolution. That's what Satan would stir up in our hearts and minds. He would want us to be scared. He wanted us to be stressed. He wanted us to want to fight. Not also in this church. I share that with you because that's Satan's perfect recipe for the perfect storm. If if he can stir us and he can make that stress seem greater than what the solution is, and he can get us to revert back to our carnal human nature, we will jump to conclusions. We will get all upset, judge a matter wrongly, and then we take matters into our own hands. We take matters into our own hands, and that's when it all erupts. Taking us away from that sure foundation, blinding us to that perfect vision of life that we have been given. Remember the quote I shared with you from Jack Sparrow? The problem is not the problem. The problem is your attitude about the problem. That's what Satan would have us focus on, the attitude. And what I want to do in this concluding message is review four. I said five last time, but I combined one of them. So I want to take it down to four. Four common areas of human nature. Human nature that Satan will attempt to stir that attitude when it comes to change, when it comes to concerns, when problems arise in our lives, when problems arise in our congregations, when problems arise in the administrations of the church. And if we're not careful, Satan will use those situations to stir that little flaw, that one tiny flaw into something major, and he will magnify it. So as we go through this, these four points, I ask us, let's be honest with ourselves. Let's be honest and ask, am I standing on that rock? The rock, the vision that gives life, or have I developed one of these destructive symptoms allowing my attitude of the problem to supersede the problem itself? Have I lost sight of the promise that Christ said the gates of hell will never prevail? Turn over to Hebrews 12 as we start to go through these, because this will actually set, the scripture sets the tone of why these things are so connected and why they're so destructive. Hebrews 12, verse 12. You know this very well. We read this quite often. We're told, therefore. So he says, therefore, here's what I would love to see happen on this rock. Strengthening the hands that hang low. Lift them up. And the feeble knees. Don't want to feel weak. God gives us strength. You can have a good foundation. You can walk upright. And then it says, make straight for your past your feet. You can see that way. You'll be able to walk it. Yes, it's difficult. Yes, the mountain's hard, but you can climb it because I've given you a way. So that you will not, what that was lame, because of you being corrected, because of that which was located, it can be healed. You have access to everything you need to keep that vision clear. Not just a desire to hear it, but know what to do with that word and that be what is required of you. And he goes on to say, pursue peace with all men. It's not easy being human. It's not easy being in a group more than one. So pursue peace. The whole book we talk about is about relationships. And relationships are not just easy. It takes time. It takes a lot to bring a lot of minds together. So he says, I've given you what you want. I've given you the perfect vision. I don't want you to perish. If you focus on this, I'll correct you. Keep going. And when you do this, pursue peace with all men. And there's a standard, one that is defined by holiness, which points you back to me. It points you back to that rock. Not what works for you, but what gives everything you need to work. Because he said, if you don't do this, you'll be like that house that's a fall, which will be great. He goes, because if you don't do this, you won't see the Lord. You won't have that vision. You won't be on that path. You'll be walking on that rod leading to destruction. God said, I give you everything you need. Looking diligently lest anyone fall short of the grace of God. God doesn't want that. Because he knows if we lose that sight, if we get on the wrong path, if we start to put our vision in place of his vision, something will actually take root in our hearts instead of his spirit changing us and transforming us. He calls it a root of bitterness. And that root will spring forth. It will cause, what did he say? Trouble. I do not like trouble. I don't like being in trouble. And I don't like to see trouble. It's heartbreaking. But this is what's interesting. It also says, and by this, many become defiled. Bitterness is a root that spreads like a weed. I'm watching Nyssa do the flower beds. Looks pretty one week. After all this rain, the weeds grow taller than the flowers. You think of all that effort to just change because you turned your back. So God says, I don't want that weed in this. Get it out. Don't give place for it, because its ill effects are endless. It will affect and bring defilement to you, and that defilement will spread if it's not dealt with. Hope. Hope can't survive in this type of environment. Just like flowers, just like a garden, weeds will choke the fruit. Weeds take away every bit of moisture. God doesn't want that in this place. So the first area, the problem, the situation, if you want to call it, I'll say a seed, is disrespect. Disrespect. And disrespect is kind of unique, because when we lose vision of who Christ is and the leader of this church, you know who the first person we disrespect is? Ourself. We disrespect ourselves. We disrespect our fellow brethren. More importantly, though, we disrespect God. We disrespect Christ. Disrespect is one of the more contagious diseases of the human heart. It spreads like wildfire. It leads to becoming irreverent. Leads to us being contempt. Bitter, like it says right here in Hebrews. From the very first moment that the church began in the wilderness, we see disrespect. Disrespecting Moses. Disrespect was present soon after AD 31. Disrespect has been present since the modern church era. Because familiarity breeds contempt, and that root of bitterness finds fertile ground. Let's go back, though. I want to look at just Moses' example and what he had to face. Everything written back then is for our learning. Numbers 12. Let's look how disrespect, how it can get into the mind of someone and change their reasoning towards the way they see themselves, the way they see the leadership, in the way they see, more importantly, Christ. Again, this is not just against leadership. This is against anybody can fall for this. Those in leadership. Because we're going to see at the end of this what it really does. It changes how we think. Numbers 12, verse 1, it says, then Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses. That word is criticized. They were starting to criticize the leader of the nation, the leader of the people. Why? Because of the decision. A decision of the Ethiopian woman whom he married, something he did, for he had married her. And then they start questioning him. I don't like that decision. I don't like what he did. I don't like what he did in his past. And they start dragging up these things. And therefore, they're no longer seeing Moses as they did before. Something's entered in their heart. And they said, has the Lord indeed spoken only through Moses? Look at him. He ain't that shiny anymore, is he? Has he not also spoken to us? I've got a Bible. I got God's Spirit. I can do this. It's not that they weren't important. they started to bring Moses down and started lifting themselves up. Isn't it quite opposite of what we're called to? Like John the Baptist said, when we're called in this wonderful way of life, we decrease. Christ always increases. You see, we're never going to agree on everything. I like the heat. You don't. A lot of people, well, Jim does. I like it when it's frigid in this room. Well, only in the summer, okay? You know me in the winter. You know, I tell people, everybody has this wonderful idea of what it means to flee, and we're all going to be in Petra, we're going to be in a cave together, or been in this fancy building together, waiting for Christ's return. I said, everything is at peace till one person touches the thermostat. The church has proven throughout my life, the man who controls the thermostat has a lot of pressure on his shoulders. And I've seen many people argue over somebody changing it without permission. It happens. Because we don't always agree. But just like Miriam here in Moses, sometimes we don't agree with the decision because we're not understanding all the conditions that took place before that decision was made. Respect doesn't just also mean that we blindly follow anyone or agree just to make peace. But what respect does, it blocked that two-way communication with Moses. They could have went to him and discussed it. Disrespect stopped that connection with the leader. And then started making their own ideas, their own new road. God talks to us, we can do this ourselves. Disrespect is a personal vendetta, which we will attempt to dominate. We'll belittle anyone around us so that we can elevate ourselves, seeing ourselves in a better position, seeking others to follow us from a lower position. We forget to see the reality. So that's what happens when we start to disrespect ourselves or who we are. We start disrespecting others around us, and we don't communicate. We create our own way. Next thing that happened, where disrespect changed a people's mindset of who they would believe. Numbers 14. Right after 12 wonderful people went to a land promised by God and came back with two different reports. 10 didn't like it, were scared to death. 2 stood up and said, the vision of what God has promised is clear. Yeah, the problem is real, but don't let our attitudes about the problem be bigger than the solution. We can conquer this because God is with us. God has done everything at this point. He can take us in. But in verse 1, in verse 14, then all the congregation lifted their voices, and because of 10 other reports, they cried and the people wept all night. And all the children of Israel murmured, our leader must be ridiculous to make us want to do this. You're looking at a man disrespecting the judgment. They did it against Moses and Aaron, and all the whole congregation said to them, if only we had died in the land of Egypt, or only if we had died in this wilderness, why has the Lord brought us to this land to fall by the sword, that our wives and children should become victims? Now we're a victim. We lost that much respect for the leadership. We lost that much respect for the vision. We lost that much respect for Christ that He no longer can protect us and we become victims. Don't we see that in the world today? This victimization mindset? All because it doesn't fit my agenda. It makes me uncomfortable. Human nature is still human nature. I can't say I wouldn't be that one like, they're kind of big. And plus, I don't like dates and raisins and goat milk and honey. Why would I put my life on the line for that? Because we don't see the vision. We lose and we don't respect what God is showing us. The problems are big at times. The problems are big. And social media sometimes makes it bigger. Just like those 10 are like the social media. They got their voices out there going. 10 voices compared to 2. Sometimes false statements make a bigger impact than facts. And we turn and we don't respect the one, and we start to worry and we lose sight. I shared this on Facebook recently. Worry doesn't take away tomorrow's trouble. It only takes away today's peace. So if we respect God, that peace He promised and what He's going to do, and respect that which He has put in front of us, we would continue to walk. We know it's just a bump. It's just a problem. We don't need to lose our peace. We don't need to lose a vision based upon a false narrative. Because sometimes flawed perspectives will fly. Look at the next one. This is a big one we see. Number 16. Disrespect will also, again, just like what we kind of talked about in the first one, we'll start to seek positions. I tell you, if you want to be a pastor, I will tell you everything. It's not easy. It's not easy being a deacon. It's hard. It's hard being an elder. It's not to beat people. It's not to, you know, to lord things over. It's to take the burden of others and be willing to be last. Korah forgot that. Korah never got that point. He didn't see that Moses gave up everything. He didn't see that the family gave up everything. Moses, number 16, it says, now Korah the son, just go with Korah. In verse 2, I'm not going to read all those names. They rose up before Moses with some of the children of Israel. See, now disrespect. They disrespect themselves. They disrespect to God. Now this disrespect is starting to affect everyone around them. And that bitterness is spreading. And it's causing an infiltration and an infestation. And it caused that root to gain strength. So they rose up before Moses with some of the children of Israel. 250 leaders of the congregation, representative of the congregation's men of renown. It even got to the leadership. And they gathered toward Moses, together against Moses and Aaron, and said, you take too much upon yourself. Who do you think you are? For all the congregation is holy, every one of them, and the Lord is among them. Why then do you exalt yourself above the congregation of the Lord? So you missed the point. Verse 10. Is that, and that he has brought you near to himself, and you and all your brethren, the sons of Levi, with you. And are you seeking the priesthood also? Therefore, you and all your company are all together against the Lord. This is the response, I'm sorry. He says, you don't know what you're doing. Moses is begging them, you don't know what you're seeking. Your disrespect, your irreverence of what God is, what he's doing, this way he ask us to build on this rock is changed. And now you want to be the leader. And you don't even really understand what it means to be the leader. Because when disrespect sets in, rebellion follows. Not against Moses. What did Moses say? Why then do you do these things? You want all these things. You're murmuring. He says, you don't realize it. Even later, God tells him, it's against me. Your rebellion is against God. And to the point, they were so blinded, they didn't realize what they were doing because of that disrespect. Because to the degree that we show disrespect, it's to that degree that we'll be unable to see Christ. We don't even see him anymore. We see ourselves. We want what we want. Again, respect. Respect is a way of life. It's a way of communication. Just like leaders have to respect those they lead. Because leaders must be led themselves. And if they lose sight of the vision, they're in a lot of trouble. Knowing how to communicate as the people of God respectfully is what we learn in Ephesians 4:16. Speaking the truth in love. A respectful way to communicate, a valuable asset that helps us be effective in administration of anything, especially when there is a problem. Pastor, I don't like that decision. Can we talk about it? deacon, I didn't like the way you did this. Can we talk about it? Not just, you messed up once, you're out of here. I could just do it better myself. God's word, building on this rock, knowing what is required, it helps us to address the problems. Knowing the expectation of what's expected of us, and do it without hesitation. We want the truth. We want to live by the truth. And that truth, as we read in Hebrews, is to seek peace. Think of David. Can you imagine being anointed king all those years and watching a leader destroy a nation? But God didn't let the nation be destroyed. He was letting something be made known. David had to wait. He didn't just go up and say, I was anointed king. Everyone come to me. We'll go rise up and destroy Saul and I'll get my throne and my crown. No, he had to run. He had to hide. He had to plead with God. But there was one moment when he was in a cave when everyone around him, his closest of friends, said, hey, now's the time, David. Let's just take this crown. Go kill him when he's vulnerable. And David went up there and he cut that piece off his garment. But what did David feel at that moment? I just disrespected myself first. I disrespected God and I've sinned before the Lord. I have to see things the way God sees. This is not an ideal situation, but I trust God. I trust the head. Point two. Point two, one of those symptoms that can arise, as you know very well, is discord. Discord. That which leads to division. You know the scripture. Proverbs 6. Should be a memory scripture. Proverbs 6, verse 16. These things the Lord hates, yes, seven are abomination to him. A proud look, a lying tongue, hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked plans, feet that are swift to running toward evil, a false witness who speaks lies, and one who sows discord among the brethren. God hates division. And if he sees that starting to take place, he will work. And there's a lot of scriptures about dealing with that. Why does God hate division that much, that type of division? That type of division? Because he has this plan, this vision where life can thrive. In fact, David wrote about it. Remember what in Psalm 133? How good and how pleasant it is for brethren to dwell together in unity. The whole idea, remember, is relationships. God wants these bonds to be built. And we put forth this effort. In fact, God sent his son to shed his blood so that that bond could be made. Because that's good. It's worth the sacrifice. Even in, seek it. And if all possible, be at peace. I know, but I give you every tool you need. Don't disrespect, and don't let that disrespect come to you and cause you to be a source of division. God desires for us to experience what he has, that vision for our lives and for us together as a congregation, across the organization. We drew the lines, not God. But why does this not exist? Why is this that God hates so easily injected into our lives? Pride. Egos. Pride and egos. I can do things myself. Isn't that what we saw with Miriam and Aaron? Korah. Men of renown. I can do this. I got a better vision. I'm not like them. We convince ourselves that we're better than others. We don't stand on the backs of our brethren. In fact, we let them stand on our backs to help them at times. And you heard this saying so often, this is so true, too many chiefs and not enough Indians at times. Everybody wants to be the one in the spotlight. It's not fun being in the spotlight. Everyone wants to be the leader. Everyone wants power. Yet, so many fail to see what true power and authority is all about. You know, I think it was before the feast, I read this part of the speech, and when I was going through about how pride and ego, how it twists and makes us want to stir discord, that famous part of that speech by Theodore Roosevelt came to my mind. Do you remember the speech I shared with you? Who wants to recite it for me? No. The man in the arena. I want to read it, but when I do this, I want us to think and consider, if I was there in Moses' day, if I was there at the onset of New Testament church, if I sat in the offices of Worldwide Church of God, if I was at the Council of Elders when they were selecting a new man to lead us. Think about, or how about this one? What if I was in the crowd when Christ was telling me what I should and shouldn't do? How would I see Christ? How would I see leaders? And am I doing that today? Roosevelt says, the poorest way to face life is to face it with a sneer. There are many men who feel a kind of twisted pride and cynicism. There are many who confine themselves to criticism as a way others do what they themselves dare not even attempt. There is no more unhealthy being, no man less worthy of respect than he who either really holds or feigns to hold an attitude of sneering disbelief toward all that is great and lofty. Whether in achievement or in that noble effort, even if it fails, comes to second achievement. Because it's not the critic who counts. It's not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles or where the doer of deeds could have done them better. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust, sweat, and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs, who comes short again and again, because there is no effort without error and shortcoming. But who does actually strive to do the deeds? Who knows the great enthusiasms? Who knows the great devotion? Who spends himself in a worthy cause? Who at best knows in the end the triumph of high achievement? And who at worst, if he fails, at least he fails while daring greatly, so that his place shall never be with those cold and timid souls who never knew victory for defeat. Are we the couch quarterback? You should have went left when you went right. You should have started at 10:30 instead of 11. That happens a lot. You said this when you should have said that. Things happen. Plenty of people like to sit on in leadership too, to think that we can do things better, because we don't always have all the information of why a decision was made. And that discord starts to build. But you know what we have on this rock? We have all the tools I mentioned to fight against it, to have that unity, to have what is written in Psalm 133. The saints on the Most High don't seek to destroy each other. They don't seek to destroy leadership. We seek to build. We seek to help. We deal with the problems. We have a ministry of reconciliation. Turn over to Romans 15. Romans 15 states, we then who are strong ought to bear with the scruples, the weaknesses of the weak, not to please ourselves, not that we get glory, but to help, to edify, because someone else gets all the attention. Because he says, let each of us please his neighbor for his good. What a radical way to live. It's not about me. I'm not the center of the universe. home. I don't like that. No. Discord makes you the center of the universe because you make yourself the standard. He said, that's not the way we do. He goes, let us each please his neighbor for his good, leading toward edification. Back in chapter 14, verse 1, it says, receive one who is weak in the faith, but do not dispute over doubtful things. Everybody's got an idea, but be patient with each other. That's Psalm 133 in action, working to make that a reality. I read a book here recently. It's not in my notes, and it's really going to kill me on time, but I want to share it. We covered these verses in the first part of the sermon in 1 Corinthians 3, where it talks about Paul planted, Apollos watered, but who gave the increase? Could Paul put more seeds in the ground and go scream at the ground, grow? Could Apollos just keep dumping water on it and on and on it, and they grow without God giving the increase? We don't have in this life power to change anyone's lives, but we have power to influence, power to help, power to grow. If I have this field, you're my field, and I have tilled it, have planted, and I finally see one little sprig coming up, and I go up there and I pull it to make it grow faster, what did I do? I killed it because I don't have the power to bring the increase. God does. Beautiful analogy. Which puts it back to the vision that brings life. Do our part. Do what's required to be in this field, in this house, and trust that our leader will bring the increase in our lives with the fruit of His Spirit. Putting forth the effort, taking in the fertilizer, being weeded if necessary, taking in that water, and asking God, let there be increase because I am trying. And that's what we do as leaders. Seeking God to provide the increase. Because we know Christ is that living head. And we all feel that. But if we focus on the failures and scream at the soil and pull on the weeds that are sitting right next to sometimes a plant, we'll uproot everything. Like Christ said, no, leave it. I'm tending this field too. I'm watching. I'm there. Don't cause discord. In mercy, air in mercy. The one I got in place, he's dirty. He's got his face, it's blood, sweat, and tears. But he's doing what I ask him to do. I'm with you. Which leads us to the next point. Which captures why God hates and commands that we properly deal with those who stir up discord. The sowing of discord began as a seed in the heart. Disobedience. Turn back to Proverbs 16. When I was going through this and looking at these, reading this, my eye caught verse 14. It's in the context of talking about a worthless person. But look what it says in verse 14. It says, perversity is in his heart. He devises evil continually. He sows discord. Why don't I go back to discord? It's because that was the end result. The very first word in that sentence is Strong's 8419. Tapuha. I think I said that wrong. Tapuha. Here in the New King James, it's translated perversity, but in the Old King James, the word is frowardness. Frowardness, which means stubborn. He that is in contrary. He who's not willing to yield or even comply to what's required due to disobedience. He's a fraud. It's sin. And it's perverse. God does not want that among His people. Because if something changes the way we see and gets in our heart, and we are not going to see God's way, His word, and we start to have a distorted vision because that disobedient mindset that I'm not going to do it your way, I'm going to do it my way, I'm not going to yield. It's like looking into water. Hey, Ben, you've done this. Some of you men have done this. Who's went bow fishing water in the water shooting? What happens when you look into the water and you go to aim? Where do you aim? At this target you see? Or you gotta know what a refraction index is. You gotta know water changes, and you gotta make a compensation. A disobedient heart changes the way we see things. Ungodly attitude, this disobedience that gets in the seed of a man, seed of a woman, changes how we see, and we lose our spiritual vision. It changes how we see ourselves. Again, it changes how we see each other. We have to ask ourselves, is what I'm doing, has that disobedience changed the way I see Christ? Has it changed the standard in which I build on this rock? What is that expectation? I got to go back to those expectations. And we know it in Romans 12, 1 and 2. What's it say? This is your reasonable service. You got to prove what God says is holy, what God says is acceptable. And then you live a life as a living sacrifice. Yielding. Not stubborn. Not in contrary. Not trying to conform. He says, you've already conformed to a wrong way. I'm trying to get you to transform. But here's the reality of how you take all that and not be disobedient. You just can't cross the dots and think you're okay. Look what Jesus says in Matthew 5. When you think about being a living sacrifice, our way of life is one that takes and looks through a vision, a spiritual vision. We don't want to be disobedient. We don't want to ignore what God says and just think we can just come to church, do a little bit of Bible study, and do this, and not be transformed. Because he says in Matthew 5, verse 23, therefore, if you bring your gift to an altar, your living sacrifice, you're coming to the altar to live, to be a sacrifice. It says, look at it this point. And there you remember that your brother has something against you. Who cares? I'm a Christian. I'm just going to do what I got to do, and Jesus can take care of it later. No, he said, stop. Stop what you're doing. You're not building properly. You think you can just continue to go and be unyielding and practice? You can just make a check mark? He goes, no, you stop right there. You leave that gift right there before the altar. You go your way and you practice what you have been taught. Go and be reconciled to your brother. Yield to my law. You're just going through and practicing law. You're not letting that law transform you. Because if my law was really being written in your heart, and that disobedient attitude that made you contrary to my way of life was gone, you would have seen that you would have never come to me without doing the law first. Implement it in your whole life. You're just trying to impress me. Let your works be what God says to, not just going through these motions. It's disobedience. You have a skewed vision of what God wants in your life because you can't even see yourself as yourself. You think you deserve what others don't. Once we lose how we see ourselves, we lose how we're to implement God's law. Once we lose how to implement God's law, we lose the sight of who Christ is. The head. The true living head. Psalm 115. Because if we can't clearly see the head to where he's leading us, then we're in trouble. Because David asked this question. I gave a sermon on this once, this chapter. Lord, who may abide in your tabernacle? Who may dwell on your holy hill? Who? He goes through and says, the one who walks uprightly, who works righteousness, who speaks the truth in his heart. It's there, it's written. He don't backbite with his tongue. He doesn't do evil to his neighbor. He doesn't take up reproach against his friends. A vile person, is despised. He honors those who fear the Lord. He swears to his own hurt. He doesn't change. He won't take a bribe against the innocent. He does these things. He who does these things, that's the one who has that proper spiritual sight. They're not stubborn, walking contrary. No, they're willing to yield. Willing to yield. They strive daily to draw closer to God. And because the closer we know we are to God, the more we'll strive to live by that example. And we understand the calling, preparing us for the kingdom of God. Not the kingdom of preferences, but God's kingdom. The fourth point, when we lose sight of who the true head of the church is, can lead us to be discouraged. We can be in a state of discouragement. We've all been there, feeling like it's just not worth it. Why continue? Why do I got to put myself through this all over again? You see, if Satan can't get us to destroy each other, he relishes in the fact that he can confuse us to the point we're discouraged and we'll just sit along on the sidelines, sitting in a living room by ourselves, overwhelmed, doing nothing, but sadly destroying ourselves. It's happened over the years. Notably, it's happened in the Bible. Remember Elijah? Did a wonderful job there. I would love to see that. How long was it when a woman, an evil woman, says, "I'm going to kill you"? You just witnessed something amazing. The power of God coming down from heaven, doing such wonderful things. And the first thing he did was like, "I'm out of here. I'm done." And God, unless you show yourself in some magnificent way, I'm done. And he hid in the cave. What about the 11 who were still alive after Christ's death? I go fishing. Discouraged. We have the perfect antidote, though. The perfect antidote to discouragement. Joshua was told this. Turn back to Joshua 1. We kind of read this a little bit last time, but I want to read, starting in verse 5, and just read it all the way through verse 9. In Joshua 1, verse 5, it says, "No man shall be able to stand before you all the days of your life." I like that one. Yeah. That makes me feel powerful and confident. "I'll be with you as I was with Moses. I won't leave you. I won't forsake you. Just be strong. Be courageous. It's going to be hard for this people. To this people you should divide as an inheritance out of the land which I swore to their fathers. I'm giving you a high calling. A really difficult task. So be strong." I love you. He repeats it. "Be courageous that you may observe to do according to all the law which Moses, my servant, command you." You're going to have to live what you have learned. Don't be discouraged. It's going to be difficult at times. He then goes and says, "Don't turn to it from the left hand. Don't turn to the left hand. That's not the path. You stay straight that you may prosper wherever you go. This book of the law shall not depart from your mouth." Don't adopt anything to make everything happy. You're not there to make people happy. You're there to lead them to the truth. You're there to get them to the promised land. You're there to get them to that reward that I promised. Don't change it. Don't be discouraged, Joshua. Stay to this book, no matter what you see going on. "You shall meditate it on every day and night, so that you may observe to do according to all that is written in it. For then you will make your way prosperous." This is the only way. Satan will try to bring all this upon you, but you got to stay in this path. Just keep going. "Have I not commanded? You heard my voice to follow me. Just keep following. Just do this. So be strong. Be of a good courage. Don't be afraid. Don't be dismayed. For the Lord your God is with you wherever you go. Paul iterated this promise in Hebrews 13:5. It was an assurance a leader of a nation had. It's an assurance the leaders in the kingdom of the millennium have as they prepare for it. We, the people of God, can't lose sight of that. That's a promise from the head that leads us. That promise stood true for the wilderness. It stood true for John's day. It stands true for us. But do we still view him in these moments of change? Do we still view him as that God who's going to do this, as that leader who's going to do this when we face things we may not understand? You start to draw this to a conclusion here. Remember the famous twins, Esau and Jacob? Who had the birthright? Who had the opportunity? But what changed that one day? Coming in, he smelt the food. Well, let's just read it. Genesis 25, verse 29. Now Jacob had cooked the stew, and Esau came from the field, and he was weary. And he said to Jacob, "Please feed me some of this red stew." He had to be hungry if he wanted lentils. I would have just said, "No, thank you. I'll eat the grass." But he says, "Please feed me some of this red stew, for I'm weary." Therefore, his name was called Edom. But Jacob said, "Sell me your birthright this day. Sell me your birthright." And Esau said, "Look, I'm about to die. So what profit shall this birthright be to me?" Then Jacob said, "Swear to me on this day." So he swore to him, and he sold him his birthright. And Jacob gave Esau bread and a stew of lentils. Then he ate and drank, arose, went away. Why? Because Esau despised his birthright. Why did Esau give up his birthright so easily? He allowed the current situation to discourage him. To discourage him to the point he did not see the true reality of what was really going on around him. He was not going to starve to death. He just wanted that instant gratification to take care of his own personal needs for a moment. The problem was too big for his patience to find a solution. It says he despised. He despised. It means he didn't see the value. He didn't see the value because he didn't have the inheritance yet. It was still out. He didn't see what would be. He was overly worried about the present that he lost sight of the long game. He put more value in the temporary. Later on it says he came back. He wanted that birthright, but he never repented. All he wanted was power. He wanted the wealth. If Satan get to us, the first roots, to make us lose sight of who we are, why we do what we do, what is our purpose, who leads us, we'll lose sight of the vision. Will we want a bowl of stew? Something temporary to make us feel good? If we lose vision of what this all leads to, we'll place our priorities in the non-essentials because of temporary disturbances. But when we focus on the head, all the things that trouble us are no longer important because we realize God won't leave. God is responsible. Christ is the head. Yes, we're going to be tested. We're going to have to be sifted at times. It's not going to be pleasant all the time. But we're in it for the long game. John 6. Went just after a very famous sermon. "I am the bread. Eat my body. Drink my blood." Giving the words of life, showing them this is what God is doing. This is what you have to commit to. John says in verse 60, "Therefore many of the disciples, when they heard this, said, 'This is a hard saying. Who can understand this?' And when Jesus knew it to himself that his disciples murmured about this, he says, 'Are you offended? Does truth hurt?'" Then verse 66, after all this, "From this time, many of his disciples went back and walked with him no more." That would be a hard, hard time. We watch people walk away from truth based upon perception sometimes, just because they didn't agree with something. And Jesus looks at them, and then Jesus said to the 12, "Do you also want to go away? You going to believe that social media post? You going to believe that rumor? Are you going to just let everyone else around you influence you more than what I can do? Influence you with truth?" Then Simon Peter said, "Lord, to whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life." We have come to believe. You've called us to this rock. We have built and we have strived. We've done everything and we dug deep. And we know that you are the head. We know you're Christ, the Son of the living God. We follow you. A profound conviction that Christ is the head of the church is what is always needed for everybody. Everyone called to be part of this church. There must be a belief. There's got to be that level of faith in this headship. I want you to do some study on your own, because I'm seeing I'm running out of time here. I want you to go back and read what we covered earlier, Hebrews 12, 1 through 3. That's what Peter is saying. This is what we look to. Hebrews 12, 1 through 3. And then chapter 10, 19 through 25, what it says, we come. We come boldly to this. This is where we draw near to with a full assurance. That's what we need in our lives. Let's see here. We got time here to read this. Also read 1 Peter 2, 1 through 10 in your studies. And we realize what we've been brought to. We didn't have this opportunity until he called us. And we had to make room. When I thought about these scriptures, about what it's called, who do we look to, this great cloud of witness that we're called to, this assembly that we're to strive to be there, stirring up one another, building on this rock, being these living stones, building on this foundation, being a chosen people, as he says, proclaiming what is right. How can we have this? I thought about a book I read every year. I just finished it last week again. Bruce Barton's the Man Nobody Knows. Bruce Barton made a couple of profound statements I want to share with you. It captures what can happen when we don't have this vision. We're not willing to put forth the effort that's required because we've fallen for one of those well-placed stumbling blocks. And our carnal human nature blinds us to what matters most. Barton writes, "The mother of Jesus knocked at the doors of the inn in Bethlehem and could not come in. It might have sheltered the greatest event in human history, and it lost its chance. Why? Why was Jesus born in a stable? Was it because the people of the inn were more vicious and hostile? No. No, the inn was simply full. There was no room. Sometimes men's lives are like the inn. No room for what matters the most. In the process of being successful, they have sacrificed success. Never once sacrificing themselves, they have forgotten everything else. Not so with Jesus. He who refused to turn aside from his business to become a king, who never was too busy to turn aside for a sick man, a friend, or a little child. He never forgot that one night his mother had stood on the threshold where there was no welcome. The threshold of a little inn in Bethlehem was so busy that the greatest event in history knocked on its doors and could not come in. When times are tough, when we're facing change, when we feel or we see the worst of men, or anyone around us, even our brethren, even our leaders, does that change how we view the head and the faith we have in the head? Does it blind us to the true vision Jesus has for his church? Are we too full of our perspective to be filled with his? Will we miss out on that moment that would drastically impact our lives because we simply didn't make room? Barton ends his book with this powerful statement. But he, speaking of Jesus, but he, when his enemies had done their worst, so bore himself that a crucified felon looked into his dying eyes and saluted him as king. What will we allow to change our vision and salute Jesus Christ as the living head of his church? Will the president change how we see Christ? Will anybody, would your pastor change how you see Christ? Our allegiances can't be split between God and man. It can't be half-hearted. If the temple, these small stones, is divided, it won't stand. But if this temple, this small stone, is placed on the rock, it has been transformed by that rock, by what it requires. It seeks, with all sincerity and truth, faithful, humble, and obedient. Because it knows it doesn't need to live in fear. The gates of hell can't prevail. What can man do? What can Satan bring? Against the church whom Christ is head. We of all people know. We know him. We've made room for him. We salute him as king. Our king is aware of our situations, individually and collectively. If there's a problem, we go to him. We trust him because we know it's his promise to solve. He gives us what we need. He's never failed us. Christ has never failed and never will. I urge us all to deeply consider, how can one accord be realized? How can truth be eternalized? How can peace and oneness be achieved? How can I continue to run this race with all confidence? I keep my eyes set on the vision of who he is, what he has done, what he is doing, and what he will faithfully continue to do to lead us all through this. Let's hold fast to the vision that gives hope, a vision that gives life, and never lose sight of the head, and always salute him as king.